So questions, comments?
I found this extremely helpful. I've noticed in myself this tendency lately to get into that view of the mind and the emergent property of the body. I've noticed, I'll be reading something that has that viewpoint and I'll get very confused. And I was wondering if you had any recommendations for practices or things I could read further on this, because I've noticed that that is an area where I get distracted.
Okay, so you're saying that you've been reading a lot of stuff where they regard the mind as the emergent property of the body, and that's causing you a lot of confusion. And so what practices or readings could you do where you're going to get a different view? Well, I think most Buddhist books would have a different view if you read them. Okay. And I think just our meditation practice itself can give us a different view. Because when we're sitting there, let's just look at our own experience. You know, just how I feel, what my feelings are about me. Do I really think that I'm just atoms and molecules? You know, when you're meditating and all that stuff is happening, is that just atoms and molecules? You know, what is our own raw experience? Yeah? And for me, I think this is what helped me have more conviction, that the mind is something different than the body. Yeah? Because when I just sit there, when I'm thinking, you know, can atoms and molecules think? Do I relate to my thoughts as all they are is electrical stuff and certain, you know, proteins or whatever it is? I don't know what dopamine and serotonin are, you know. But, you know, is that how I relate to my emotions? No. That's not how I relate. You know, what is my actual gut experience? It's not that my consciousness is just, you know, boils down to my body. Okay. Yeah. And then you can also begin to see that your body's telling you one thing, but you can change what your body's telling you. Like, you know, when you're, let's say you're sitting and meditating and you have some pain, yeah, then, okay, you know, the body's saying pain, 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 pain. Well, you know, go in your meditation and just investigate what is that pain. Yeah? And you kind of discover it's just sensation. It's just sensation. Yeah? There's no real pain there in the body. It's just sensation. Like you sit there and you say, okay, there's pain in my knee. And you realize that you have the concept of here's my body in this shape and there's my knee and there's a pain in it. But what about if you didn't conceptualize in that way? What if you didn't visualize having a body sitting in that shape with a pain? What about if there was just a sensation sitting out there in space? Yeah? You getting what I mean? You kind of play with these things. Question what your perceptions are. Yeah? Or like, I do this because I'll say, oh, I'm so tired. Yeah? And for years I just watch. I say, oh, I'm so tired. And then I started asking myself, how do I know I'm tired? Because I say I'm tired, and as soon as I'm tired, boy, that is my excuse to be in a bad mood. Okay? Because I say to myself, I'm tired, so I'm in a bad mood. Yeah. So then I started asking myself, how do I know I'm tired? It's like asking yourself, how do I know my leg hurts? How do I know I'm tired? So when I started doing that, I mean, what the question actually was on what basis, what was the basis of the label that I was giving the label tired? And I figured out that tired for me is I have a certain feeling like right here, you know, right around my eyes. There's a certain sensation. And on the basis of that sensation, I say, I'm tired. It was so weird to kind of see that. It's like, you know, that's really why I say I'm tired, is because there's a certain sensation around my eyes. Yeah. I'm not necessarily even falling asleep when I'm tired. I can be tired without falling asleep. Yeah. So I didn't tell you that up until now, because then I'd have to give up my excuse for being in a bad mood. I'm joking, but, you know, it can be interesting to question your experience this way and say, well, what actually is my body and what is my mind? Yeah, is tired actually a physical state, or is it a mental state? Is pain a physical state, or is it a mental experience? So that might help a little bit. And then some books, Ian Stevens wrote this book, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. And then there's some other books that some scholars have done recently too. I can't remember the names.
Mm-hmm. If you go to challengepastlives.org, and you go on to, you click library, then they have all these cases where this guy, like, cataloged in detail, into unreasonable doubt, like aliens had told this person about someone else's life, you know, like into unreasonable doubt. That there's no way there could be any option other than them being reborn and having past life memories. There's a whole...
It's called childspastlife.org.
I think. Or children's past
life. Okay. And then there's also certain, there's definitely stories and reports that people have had. I remember seeing one video that they were interviewing one woman in Britain, you know, and she wasn't brought up believing in rebirth or anything, but they were interviewing her. She was an elderly woman, and elderly or middle-aged, something. Anyway, she was saying that ever since she was a kid, she always thought about a certain village, and she knew the name, and she could imagine all the streets, and, you know, she knew some of the residents in there and kind of had the feeling that she had a family there. And she had this kind of imaginative village, you know, that she knew about ever since she was young. But when she got older, she started doing some research, and she found out that there was actually a village by that name. And she began to realize that what she thought was imagination, you know, maybe were memories, because she had memories of having, I think it was 5 kids, and, you know, her elder son's name was this and that, and, you know, this memory of this whole life that she had since she was a kid. So she found that village. And she went there, and she met her son from her previous life. Yeah, and he was an old man at that time. So, yeah, she must have been middle-aged. And he was an old man, and he started telling stories from his childhood that corresponded exactly with her memories from her previous life. You know, it's amazing. Or you have a situation like in Tibet, when they recognize the incarnations of previous masters, they'll take the property of the previous master and mix it in with things that belong, you know, that look just as glittery or whatever. And the child will be able to pick out the property that was theirs in a previous life.
And right. Identify names of people.
Yeah, they can identify names of people and all sorts of things, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's how they found the present Dalai Lama. They sent the search party out, but it was disguised as merchants. You know, because if you go out as a bunch of monastics saying, we're looking for the Dalai Lama, well, everybody's going to say, it's my kid, you know. So they go out in disguise. And in old Tibet, there were no hotels. So when you were traveling and you needed to stop somewhere, you just stopped at, you know, a farmhouse. And everybody offered other people hospitality. So Kechop Rinpoche, he was the head of the search party. He was disguised in the search party as the one who took care of the animals. Okay, in the merchant party, and other people were disguised as the merchants. And why he was disguised as the one who took care of the animals was because in old Tibet, in the hospitality, the important people in the party, they ate and they were housed in the shrine room. But the people who tended the animals, they went to the kitchen with, you know, all the people who worked in the household. And all the children, because that's where the children hung out, in the kitchen, not in the shrine room. So Kechop Rinpoche was, you know, disguised as somebody who took care of the animals. In this one house, you know, he went inside, and there was this little two-year-old boy who jumped on his lap, and he was wearing some a mala. I don't know if he had it around his neck or around his hand or something. But the kid started pulling on it, saying, this is mine, this is mine. And somebody else said, well, or maybe it was Kechop Rinpoche, they said, you know, well, I'll give it to you if you could, you know, tell me, you know, who is this person? And he said, oh, you're Kechop Rinpoche. You know, he recognized him from the past life. So, you know, there's things that happen like this that give us some kind of, you know, it's other people's actual experience. I had a woman come up to me one time in Florida after I had given a talk about rebirth at a public library. She wasn't Buddhist or anything. She came up to me and she said, wow, that was really helpful because I think I understand my son much better. Because he was always very musically inclined and nobody else in the family was. Nobody in the family knew anything about music. But whenever he would hear a piece of music, he could identify, oh, this is Beethoven's symphony number, blah, blah. You know, he said, I never knew how this kid, my son understood this, how he knew this. He said, well, maybe, you know, previous life he had been a musician and this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Did you ever wonder about why you have certain tendencies and habits in this life? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Why from the time you were very little you just had certain likes or dislikes, certain personality habits or certain traits, things you kind of did automatically? Well, you know, it's because in previous lives we're familiar with doing certain things, so those kind of habits continue into this life. It doesn't mean that's who we are, because remember, everything's conditioned, so everything can be changed. But it just means that, you know, we don't come in as blank slates, that there's some kind of conditioning going on there. So the mind is separate from the body. Because if the mind were the body, then, you know, those kinds of things shouldn't happen. You know, there's, if the mind were the body, then neither nature nor nurture should work. Because everything would be determined by the genes. Other questions? Yeah? Oh, yeah, so when you talk about emptiness, is it normal that your ego feels like it wants to scream? Yes. Yeah. No, it means that you know, something's hitting home, and ego's going, wait a minute, I'm here, I'm in charge of the show. So look at that thing that says, I'm here, I'm in charge of it. Examine it. Where is it? What is it?
That's scary, though.
Hmm? Yeah. It's scary, and this is why we do purification practices and practices to create positive potential or merit, because as we purify and then imbue our mind stream with positive potential, it makes our mind riper, so that when we have just inklings of these insights, we don't get so scared. Okay, the mind has more stability. It's upheld by the positive potential.
Mm-hmm. And that the ego on a conventional level exists as a designation on the basis of ignorance?
Well, okay, ego is a very confusing word. Okay, because it's actually a Freudian word, that's something quite neutral. You know, in a Freudian context, and he was the inventor of the word, it's something that mediates between the subconscious and the superconscious, you know. But that's in that kind of view of society, you know, a view of the mind, which is quite different. I'm using ego to mean ignorance, the combination of ignorance and self-centeredness. Okay.
So those are the causes.
Ignorance.
So upon those causes of ignorance and self-grasping, the ego is like, that's the word.
No, the ego, okay, it's the basis, and it's also the thing that's doing the labeling and the grasping. Okay.
And every time I do the nature of the mind meditation that we have, you know, I'm going to talk about, you know, think about the subject. Who's actually perceiving? You know, there's evidently something there that is perceiving.
Yeah.
And then there's this other thing that misperceives. You know, so I don't want to get hooked into inherently labeling even the subject, but
yeah.
I really want to be able to kind of loosen this up, and on a conventional level, it still does have a label.
Right. But still, you know, what is it that's perceiving, even on a conventional level? Forget about right consciousness or wrong consciousness. Yeah.
And that one, that when I, you know, what is perceiving, there is an awareness that has a particular flavor to it that is sitting here that's doing that perceiving.
But does it always have that flavor and awareness? Is it always the same?
No, that's the way it's perceived much better than
some days it's not there, some days it's, you know, different. Yeah. Is there anything that you can say is some kind of fixed subject there? Yeah. No, it's changing, isn't it?
But to do that meditation and not to hold on to what is perceiving.
Yeah.
As Nancy's
perceiving. Right.
When in fact,
yeah. Because that's what we do, you know. It's like, okay, there's perception, so then we say, we give it a label, you know, mind or Nance or Harry or, you know, and then we go, that's it. You know, there's something solid there that's perceiving, independent of the perception and the process of perceiving. Well, no, there isn't.
Mm-hmm. But it's really big.
Yeah.
When you get some distance from the label.
Yeah. Because we realize that whatever we call perceiver, you can't label something as perceiver unless there's an object perceive and a process of perceiving. That there's no independent perceiver hanging out there in space waiting for a totally independent object hanging out there in space. And a totally independent, you know, action of perceiving hanging out there in space, all separately existent, waiting to come together. Mm-hmm. It's not the way it happens.
They're all dependent on each other.
Yeah, they're all labeled independence upon each other. Yeah. It's just, it's like, look at the label parent and child. Okay, you usually think, oh, the parents exist first and then the child exists. But actually, is there a parent without a child? Is there a child without a parent? Yeah, parents and child actually are designated in dependence upon each other. You don't have somebody who's a parent without there being a child that is existing. And you don't have somebody who's a child without there being a parent existing.
Well, how do you think about that in terms of the prosperity or the prostration and those are prostrating?
The same thing. Yeah? We say prostration. What's a prostration? Yeah?
Just these movements.
What's a prostration? It's just there's a body doing a certain series of movements. You know, and the mind doing something and, you know, the room organized in such a way. But that's all a prostration is. You know, there's no solid prostration out there that we're doing. Yeah? Huh? The same thing with the Buddhas. There's no solidly existent Buddhas. The Buddha exists merely by being labeled. Yeah? Upon the basis of designation, an enlightened body and mind. To have enlightened bodies and minds, and there's unenlightened bodies and minds. Yeah? This whole conventional world is created, everything in relationship to everything else. It's designated in relationship to other things. Nothing exists on its own. Yeah?
This might be a strange or stupid question, I think, but why do we do, for example, mantras in Sanskrit if we have the same attitude towards it? Would it just be an arbitrary label, these mantras that we're studying?
Okay. So the mantras, aren't they kind of just arbitrary things? The labels are arbitrary. But on conventional levels, things have certain functions. Okay, so I can't, you know, this thing that has numbers that tells time, I can't label it a grapefruit or a giraffe. Why not? Because it doesn't function. It doesn't do the function of what our notion of a grapefruit is or what our notion of a giraffe is. Now, before we gave out the sounds grapefruit and giraffe and developed definitions for those words, before that, I could have called this object a giraffe. And we could have all agreed that this thing that tells time is a giraffe. Because the sound is totally arbitrary, okay? But once we have a certain conceptual framework, and once things function in a certain way, then you can't just call anything anything. So the thing with the Sanskrit syllables is that there's a certain vibration to the syllables, okay? And so that vibration functions in a different way than, let's say, the vibration of the English syllables do. It's like, you know, rock music. The vibration of the rock music, you know, has a very hedonistic vibration. You listen to that music and desire energy arises or anger energy arises. Other kinds of music, the vibration gives rise to different moods. Okay, so there is conventional functioning, how things relate together, how they function together. Yeah? So things depend on how they interrelate with other things. Okay. And so for that reason, you know, the vibrations of the Sanskrit syllables, we keep them in Sanskrit. Yeah. Let's sit quietly and then we'll do the dedication.